Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Thanks for listening to Unchained, your no-hype resource for all things crypto, on the CoinDesk Podcast Network. You can also listen to the episodes on the Unchained feed earlier if you subscribe there. Plus, check out all our content on our website, unchainedcrypto.com.
I think there's really two forcing functions that are going to drive money into this thing. It's the debt situation, just the fact that, you know, the U.S. isn't going to default on their debt. There's a low likelihood we're going to have some type of like utopian AI productivity boom or something like that. The most likely scenario as it pertains to the debt is that the United States is going to have to let inflation run hot. And then the other piece is demographics, as, you know, younger people kind of take the helms of capital allocation. You know, they're more digitally native, et cetera. So, you know, I don't know if I necessarily even think that we're going to kind of have these traditional cycles that we've been used to over, you know, we have a pretty small sample.
Super cycle, man. You going the super cycle world?
Look.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Unchained, your no-hype resource for all things crypto. I'm your host, Laura Shin, author of The Cryptopians. I started covering crypto 8 years ago, and as a senior editor at Forbes, was the first mainstream media reporter to cover cryptocurrency full-time. This is the April 16th, 2024 episode of Unchained. Polkadot is the original and leading Layer 0 blockchain with over 2,000 plus developers. And the Polkadot 2.0 upgrade will be a massive accelerator for the ecosystem, making it faster, more secure, and adaptable. Perfect for GameFi and DeFi to build, grow, and scale. Join the community at polkadot.network/ecosystem/community. Today's topic is the Bitcoin halving and its overall impact on Bitcoin and the wider crypto markets. Here to discuss are Arthur Hayes, CIO of Maelstrom, and Will Clemente, co-founder of Reflexivity Research. Welcome, Arthur and Will.
Yo, yo, yo.
What's going on? Great to be here, Laura.
Next week is the fourth Bitcoin halving, when we will see the number of new Bitcoins minted with each new block halved from 6.25 to 3.125. What's unusual about this particular halving is that the Bitcoin price has actually risen ahead of the halving, and that actually typically happens about a year or a year and a half after the halving. Although it might seem obvious that the reason for that was the approval of spot Bitcoin ETFs here in the US, I don't know if you, Arthur and Will, think that any other factors came into play, so you can feel free to mention that if you think there were others. But my main question is, how do you think the fact that we've had this new all-time high already before the halving will affect the price trajectory post-halving? And so people can differentiate voices. Why don't we start with Arthur, and then we'll go to Will.
Sure. So obviously, the approval of the US Bitcoin ETFs has been amazing. It's the best-selling product, I think, in BlackRock, Fidelity, like the whole asset manager space for ETFs in their history. So they're loving the fees, all the AUM inflows. And obviously, we're seeing on a daily basis a few hundred million dollars of new fiat being pumped into the crypto ecosystem, which has obviously led for the prices to rise. So I think that's probably the big macro trend. Obviously, you have the halving. Everyone likes to look at the past cycles and divine how it's going to be exactly the same, but obviously every cycle is different. This is the main narrative of this cycle is sort of the addition of a Bitcoin derivative that institutional investors globally can invest in. And so we're really tied to those flows in terms of how the price action is going to eventuate. And I think having sort of takes a second step to that, and maybe it'll be a lot more pronounced in terms of its impact 3, 6, 9 months down the road. But I would say that we're primarily focused on what are those daily flows out of the US. Obviously, Hong Kong has approved its own spot Bitcoin ETFs, and those should be launched sometime soon. So, and Europe, UK, everyone's trying to get out on this fee game in terms of a TradFi asset manager. So I think that's the trend, having a sort of a second fiddle this cycle.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think, you know, even these prior historical cycles, it's hard to say, is this because of the halving? Is this because of just kind of the macro liquidity cycles? Is it a combination of both? Is it the behavioral dynamics in the market? I think one thing that's for sure is that, you know, the halving has a, you know, diminishing impact on the overall kind of the supply shock that we like to ascribe that it does to the market. You know, just in terms of the percentage of overall circulating supply relative to, you know, that kind of cutting in half of the issuance. So I don't necessarily think it has an immediate impact on the market. I think, as Arthur said, you know, you go out months from now, then over time it will start to have an impact. I do think the story of, you know, kind of this cycle is basically, you know, the fact that you've unlocked passive flows to come into the market for the first time. This is something that we haven't had historically, and, you know, indices have been the beneficiary of for, you know, 2 to 3 decades. So I think for the first time, as Arthur mentioned, you know, you're able to have all these pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, et cetera. They're able to kind of passively allocate to this stuff in a way that maybe they weren't able to before because of like regulatory or compliance reasons or whatever it may be.
And so, you know, those are, I believe, a different type of investor than what we've typically seen. So how would you think that would affect Bitcoin's price or volatility, but even things like the decentralization of Bitcoin? Just curious for both of your thoughts on, you know, this. I agree with you that we're sort of in a new phase now that we have this new class of investors here. But how do you see them impacting all those different factors?
I mean, I've come out pretty strongly saying that, taken to the extreme, that passive investing, and we've seen this in traditional equity markets, is toxic to price discovery. And so we'll see how large these asset managers get in terms of the percentage holding of Bitcoin and maybe some other cryptos and shitcoins as well, and whether their passivity and their non-engagement with the actual underlying protocols and what we're here to do, which is, you know, create a whole new financial system, does that detract from achieving that goal or not? So I think the jury is still out. I don't know what percentage of the network, so total supply that BlackRock and co owns, well, 1% or something like that. We're well far away from any sort of like doomsday scenario, but it's definitely there.
Yeah, I think for me in the, you know, like foreseeable future, the decentralization stuff isn't like a huge concern. I do think the volatility will just naturally come down over time as Bitcoin becomes larger, becomes more liquid, more volume, etc. I think the other side of that, you know, obviously that's less, you know, less favorable for somebody looking to allocate just because of the return profile that Bitcoin may generate. But on the flip side of that, you know, I do think it de-risks the asset in a way that, you know, maybe it wasn't de-risked 5 or 10 years ago. Like, I think you can make an argument that Bitcoin at 70K is more de-risked than it was maybe at 10K, just because of the infrastructure, you know, the kind of decline in career risk now that's brought on by Larry Fink going on and shilling our bags on live television and talking about how Bitcoin's digital gold, et cetera. So I would argue that in a lot of ways, you know, as Bitcoin gets larger, it actually becomes less risky to a lot of these super large, you know, pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, et cetera.
And then, so earlier you both said that you felt that because of the approval of the spot Bitcoin ETFs, that that is kind of the main driver for this particular cycle, less so than the halving itself. But I wanted to float a theory by you, which is I kind of felt a little bit like just the sheer amount of money that we saw come into the spot Bitcoin ETF so quickly, you know, well beyond pretty much nearly every projection I had seen out there. I wondered if you felt that we reached this new all-time high almost like in a delayed way. Sorry, I know that doesn't sound correct because obviously this came ahead of the halving. But what I'm trying to say is that it's sort of like the price maybe had been artificially depressed before because the spot Bitcoin ETFs had been, the approval of them had been delayed for so long, you know, like it took this court case and all that. And so I wondered basically, like if you think that maybe it had happened on time, which, you know, we could debate about when that was, but at some point in the last, you know,
2013
when
the legal clowns first tried to get one listed.
Right. Well, you know, at some point in the last 10 years, obviously it's a very, very long time. I imagine it's probably historically, you know, a very much longer than the average application. So assuming that, then Do you still feel like this halving will have less of an impact? Or like, basically, how do you see those two things coming together? Like, do you still think we will have a fresh new all-time high? Do you think it'll not be quite as high as it's been in the past? Or do you think it will still be, you know, a big jump from the most recent all-time high?
Well, I mean, I think just look at why are institutional investors investing in Bitcoin? Because there's a whole narrative about the destruction of the sovereign bond market, which started basically as the Fed started raising rates in March of 2022. So there's a reason why people are allocating to Bitcoin, not just that Bitcoin exists, and so therefore I will allocate however many billions have gone into these products. There's an actual underlying issue with the markets that's propelling this. So if you take away the Bitcoin ETF, it was still, you know, pending, I think maybe we wouldn't be at an all-time high, maybe at 50,000 or 45,000, whatever it is. But we've rallied off of 16,000 after the FTX collapse. And that's all predicated on a lot of money printing from the Fed, the BOJ, ECB, PBOC, all the major culprits in this fiat debasement orgy that's going on globally. And now institutional investors have a way to say, okay, I'm not just going to sell my bonds. Now I have something else to invest in that's not GLD. And that's why you have all these inflows. It's not just that Bitcoin's here and therefore I will allocate. There's an underlying economic tension there.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you can look at a gold chart and, you know, gold's been ripping the last couple months. And I think that's because of the fiscal situation. I think ultimately that's the big picture for Bitcoin. I think there's really two forcing functions that are going to drive money into this thing. It's the debt situation, just the fact that, you know, the US isn't going to default on their debt. There's low likelihood we're going to have some type of like utopian AI productivity boom or something like that. The most likely scenario as it pertains to the debt is that the United States is going to have to let inflation run hot. And then the other piece is demographics, as, you know, younger people kind of take the helms of capital allocation. You know, they're more digitally native, et cetera. So, you know, I don't know if I necessarily even think that we're going to kind of have these traditional cycles that we've been used to over, you know, we have a pretty small sample.
Super cycle, man. You going the super cycle? Ah.
Look. I don't know if super cycle means, you know, we have like straight move, you know, up to the moon and in a couple candles, but it's kind of just this fact, you know, I think that you've got an underlying shift in the market participants and the type of flows that are now coming in. So I tend to think that Bitcoin will kind of just trade as, you know, like an upwards grind up and to the right, maybe with less volatility, but more similar to kind of how indices have traded. And, you know, if you look at a lot of, you know, different risk assets, again, I think gold has also been a reflection of this. I think a lot of people have really started to focus or at least wake up to kind of the fiscal situation. And I suspect that Bitcoin will probably be the fastest horse over the coming years as, you know, a way to kind of hedge against that.
This is so funny because this whole thing about the super cycle or whatever you want to call it, I actually had that as one of my last questions, but I want to just bring it up now because, I mean, you just did, but then the other thing is you're not the first, you know, person I've seen who's actually said this and not like in a mocking way about, you know, 3AC or Suju or anything like that. So there was a tweet by Naval Ravikant. He said, quote, the narrative for this cycle is, quote, this will be the last cycle. So Arthur, you were kind of laughing about that, but why don't we just discuss it seriously? Like, will, you know, what made you say that? And I mean, I guess you kind of elaborated on what it might look like, but yeah, I'm curious just to hear your thoughts, both of you.
Yeah. To be clear, I'm not saying that like, we're going to go up only and never have any drawdowns, right? Like, I just think the drawdowns will probably be more muted, like maybe, you know, 30, 40, 50%. But also I think the upside vol will be capped as well, but I think Bitcoin will probably, you know, trade more with this kind of, you know, just general upwards grind up and to the right because of the monetary debasement over time.
Arthur.
Yeah. I mean, I think that maybe there's no such thing as like a permanent plateau, right? I'm not fucking Irving Fisher in 1929 thinking that stocks are never going to go down, right? That's just dumb. Stuff goes up and down. We're humans. We promise a future and then it gets there and it's kind of like blah, 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 right? So I think maybe the cycle is just longer and the upside is just higher, but there will be an 85-90% drawdown in crypto. I am very confident in that. We might not adhere to this four-year cycle because I think we're in the moment where the global investor class and the proletariat loses faith in this thing called Keynesian economics and, you know, deficit financing. And so if we have a revolt of the bond market saying, fuck, I don't want to own JGBs, treasuries, you know, bunds, all these bonds of these bankrupt governments, and here's this digital alternative, we could see a very explosive upside cycle. And then maybe if we throw all the baby boomers out of power around the world, the younger generation is like, well, why am I paying for healthcare for a bunch of Muppets? Let's reorganize the system. And then we might see some more responsible governance in terms of spending. And then at that point, maybe a government bond is a better bet than owning on Bitcoin on a forward-looking basis. So I think things can change. We obviously think that the same crop of idiots who run the world are going to continue doing so. And, you know, the same sort of deficit financing policies are going to prevail for the foreseeable future. But that's not going to be the case in 5 years' time. Things are different. So I think that would be my caveat to the super cycle. And I hope the more people who say super cycle, the more I'll be ready to start dumping bags. But I don't think we're there yet.
Wait, and so, but you did say that you felt that we were going to see an 80 to 90% drawdown again.
Absolutely.
Okay. And I'm just curious about that, because I just would have imagined with the presence of this new kind of spot Bitcoin ETF investor that they are, you know, just kind of like doing their little portfolio thing and maybe they rebalance now and then. But I would imagine a lot of them are sort of long term, and that would kind of create a base that would prevent these massive drawdowns. But you think even with that, we'll still see these big drawdowns?
I mean, S&P still went down from what? I don't know, like was down 30, 40, 50% in 2008. And you still have the same sort of mechanics of passive investing then, right? There is a very risk off event and the markets reacted. So whatever it is, the challenge to whatever the narrative is in two, three years time of, okay, there's just going to keep printing money forever. Maybe the demographics change in terms of who's in power and sort of those assumptions are invalidated. And you see this massive swing to the other direction. Like, okay, well, maybe we don't need to own this much of Bitcoin. There's something else that makes more sense. And the change of that narrative, because it's so well entrenched, could lead to a massive decline in the price.
Okay. But you don't necessarily see, because typically that's been on this four-year cycle with the halving, but now you're saying like it could happen, but maybe not because of this four-year cycle.
I think that we might be in a more elongated cycle because there's a whole, we're crescendoing into a collapse of the sovereign bond market, or a belief that there's something better to own than a treasury, a bund, a JGB, or whatever.
Okay. All right. So I know we were super zoomed out. This was super interesting, by the way. But now let's zoom in. So we're about a week away from the halving as of the time of this recording. And by the time the episode comes out, we'll be just a couple of days away. So what would be your best guess for what would happen to the Bitcoin price in the short term?
Yeah, I tend to think that it'll probably be somewhat of like a kind of sell the news type of event. I think anybody that was going to buy Bitcoin in the short term because of the halving probably has already done so. Actually, Arthur put out a piece whatever, like 2 days ago or something. I agree with mostly what he wrote in there. I just think that, you know, whenever there's an event that everybody's kind of expecting, you know, the people that are going to buy have kind of already bought into it. So I tend to think we probably kind of at least chop around until then and then maybe start to grind up, at least as it pertains to the kind of direct impact of the halving itself.
Yeah, I tend to agree. It's sell the news. But again, you could be wrong. Most people are already invested. So it's not as if it's like, let's go short Bitcoin. It's, hey, I'm going to hold off and maybe I'll allocate more a week, 2 weeks, a few months after the halving. I think that's probably just going to be very boring. And we're entering the summer. People are going to be on vacation. So I think we're entering that low volatility, boring period. And sort of the halving sort of just starts that period.
So a couple of other things that I wanted to look at, Will, I know you have often looked at on-chain indicators for your analysis, and there's one in particular that I was curious about, which is the realized price, which basically is where you take every coin, you multiply it by the price of its last movement, and then you divide the value of that by the circulating supply. And you have said that you feel this is one of the biggest drivers of Bitcoin's price dynamics. So what are you seeing now in terms of realized price and how that might affect Bitcoin in the short to medium term?
Yeah, I used to track a lot of the on-chain analytics stuff like pretty closely. And what I found is it's not that actionable for trading, at least on like short to medium term timeframes. What I do think it's decent for is kind of getting kind of a proxy of like the valuation of Bitcoin. There's not a lot of great ways to value Bitcoin. Some people like to look at the energy price. This MVRV thing is one of my favorite kind of valuation methodologies that people have come up with for Bitcoin. So it basically compares the realized value to the market value. As you just described, realized value is basically looks at the price that every coin was last moved. It essentially gives you kind of an aggregated cost basis of the network. And so then the idea of comparing that to what the current marginal trading price is basically, you know, where's the market trading relative to the cost basis of the network? So what we've seen historically is whenever this ratio gets up to a ratio of about 6-7, the market's kind of topped out. Whenever it goes negative, it means that the market is underwater in aggregate. So that's kind of when you want to be buying. It's kind of more of an art than a science, but it's something that I kind of look at as, okay, you know, on this kind of spectrum of valuation, based on kind of where Bitcoin has historically topped out, you can get somewhat of a rough proxy as to, you know, kind of how it's trading and where maybe it sits and kind of its cyclical dynamics. So right now we're kind of just sitting kind of midway in between both of those bounds. I don't really think there's anything super actionable to derive from that. We're still not in that undervalued territory, but we're still not in that super overheated territory that was, you know, reached at the end of 2017 or the end of 2021.
And out of curiosity, with the introduction of spot Bitcoin ETFs and now this kind of new class of holders who are all represented by, you know, one big entity on chain, or even if they have multiple wallets, still it's like, you know, all these people are grouped together now. Does that make it harder for you to do this type of analysis? Like, are you less able to detect certain trends that you could see before, or how is this affecting your analysis?
I mean, I guess you could make an argument that, you know, the coins maybe are transferring, but they're not moving on chain. But, you know, they're ultimately, you know, if people are redeeming the shares and the coins are moving, so, you know, you're still kind of seeing that impact in terms of like the profit and loss type of metrics. But I do think things like, you know, selling of GBTC recently, you know, that's like impacted. We've seen like a large influx of like older coins being spent that haven't moved in over a year. But, you know, I don't necessarily think that's like a inorganic thing that's showing up in some of the data. It's just a reflection of like the market participant behavior, like the coins haven't moved. But overall, I don't think it's like something that I would say, like, I don't follow the MVR ratio thing because of that.
Okay. So now let's talk about the macro environment. We're recording the day after the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that the Consumer Price Index, which is a measure of inflation, had risen to 3.5% in the last year. That was higher than what analysts had expected. It seems like now the market is pricing in 2 rate cuts as opposed to 3. So, you know, if you think, or if inflation continues to not fall as has been projected, despite these high interest rates, like, what do you think could happen in terms of Bitcoin?
Well, I mean, I think, and I've been banging on about this drum for a while, the Fed and the Treasury, at least in the US perspective, are net stimulative. And because the stock of US debt is so high and all these other Fed programs that they have, reverse repos, interest on excess reserves, taken together, they've been stimulative for a while, because as they raise rates, they pay more interest out to banks and wealthy individuals who spend that money into the economy, right? And so I think the focus on whether it's 2 or 3 rate cuts or maybe it's 0 is kind of irrelevant, because Fed and the Treasury are already printing money. The more they raise rates, if they do that, they print money. They cut rates, juice the markets, essentially it's stimulative as well. And so it doesn't really matter what they do, unless the US is going to declare some debt jubilee and just extinguish all the debt. The net effect is stimulative. There's more liquidity in the system. And so I think parsing, you know, Powell's statements on debt dependent and, you know, 1/10 of CPI here and another 1/10 of CPI there is fucking just mind-bendingly boring and dumb, because it doesn't matter. Like, Bitcoin's going to go up whether the Fed cuts 2 or 3 times, if they even cut at all. You know, there's some people who are saying that they're going to reduce the pace of quantitative tightening by, I don't know, $30 billion per month or something around that. And they'll announce it at the May meeting. Again, at the end of the day, they have so many ways to print money that isn't the quantitative easing that everyone understands from 2008 that it doesn't really matter. So that's my particular view on that particular situation.
Yeah, I don't really think I have anything to add. Completely agree. I think interest rates are basically just stimmies for people that buy assets.
Yeah, well, so I did want to ask you, because you kind of used a similar language earlier, but I'm just going to ask you directly about this. You tweeted, well, quote, "People are still focused on rate cuts when they don't really matter. Interest payments are stimmy checks for people that buy assets, and debates debasement is program without a utopian AI fueled productivity boom that closes in debt to GDP. So can you talk about this? Like, what do you view as this utopian AI fueled productivity boom? And
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the idea that, you know, you would have this massive influx in productivity and, you know, a massive increase in, you know, economic output that was brought on by some new technology. But I also think you can make an argument that you don't want that productivity boom to come on too quickly, because if it comes on too quickly, then it's going to displace too many jobs and then people are going to be out of work. And then, you know, you have some issues there as well. So it's almost like, you know, not only would you need some type of, you know, miracle in terms of this productivity boom, but you also need it to take place not too fast, but also not too slow. So I just think that if you have like kind of a distribution curve of probabilities, the probability of the US basically just, you know, doing some type of debt jubilee like Arthur just described is pretty low. Because why would anybody want to hold the US's debt after that? The probability of some type of crazy, you know, productivity boom that closed in the debt to GDP ratio is also pretty low. The you know, real meat of that distribution curve is they just let inflation run hot. And like, they're not going to come out and say that. But I think you've already kind of seen this in terms of, you know, Powell kind of hinting at basically like changing the inflation target. And I think, you know, they want inflation to run at 3-4%. They don't want runaway inflation that's going to cause like civil unrest, but they need it to be able to service the debt in nominal terms.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, we also do have the election this year. I don't know if it probably seems like you guys think that also factors in. Go ahead.
I listened to a very good presentation. Forgot the man's last name. First name is Matt. He's a strategist at a BCA Research and gave a geopolitical breakfast a few days ago. And my biggest takeaway was, and he had a great chart, and it showed projected spending under a Trump presidency or a Biden presidency. Trump, he believes, will spend more money, but Biden is going to spend a fuck ton of money as well. So it all ultimately doesn't matter who wins the election. Like, they're going to print money to hand it out to whoever their constituents are. Trump wants to do tax cuts, Biden has green energy or whatever, right? So it doesn't really matter. It's a fun little circus that everyone gets to watch about two old dudes fighting it out in the media. But other than that, it's irrelevant.
Wow. Okay. Well, something that I think you do think is important is the ending of the bank term funding program, because you wrote about that. So you talk about how you think that will affect the price of Bitcoin.
So I was out publicly before the BTFP expired, and I said that that would be a net negative in terms of liquidity because the banking system would come under stress because all these banks who were basically soft bailed out by this program would no longer be able to access it. And in the weeks and months leading up to the cessation of the BTFP, the Fed and the Treasury came out and they said, hey, banks, we really would like you to use the discount window because we believe that that is a better way for you to access financing. We want to remove the stigma from accessing the discount window. And if people, you know their banking history, you typically banks only access a discount window when they're about to fail, and other banks will refuse to deal with them if they know that they've accessed a discount window. And so the Fed and Treasury are trying to say, hey, use this policy measure. And it's a great policy measure because it's been around since, I don't know, 1913 or whenever the Fed was created, and therefore it has no negative stigma. Like, the bank term funding program is seen as a bailout of the banks, which is bad politically for most American voters. And so that's why they had to end that. And in the place they put the discount window, and there's some very nuances about how they differ. But at the end of the day, the Fed has unilateral authority to change the way in which loans are given out by the discount window. And they continue the same bailout under the BTFP. So I got that wrong. They came up with another way to bail out the banks. They just use a discount window. They've told everybody, if you have trouble, use this over here. And they can change the terms however they want. And that's sort of politically benign versus the BTFP, which was a political hot potato.
Okay. Well, let's talk about one other thing that I feel has just been an overhang over the crypto industry for quite a while now, which is just the regulatory environment in the U.S. Hilariously, I asked Olaf Carlson a question about this, and he said something like, it's been like this always, so it's no different. But, you know, when we have something like Coinbase, which is the largest entity in the U.S., for the crypto space, in this lawsuit with the regulator. And, that's just, Obviously not either a good look or even good for the industry, I think, just because it sort of perpetuates this notion that it's sort of lawless. But I just wanted to hear your thoughts on, you know, what you thought the market was thinking of issues like that. For such a big entity like Coinbase.
I don't really think it matters that much, to be honest. Like, I think it's something you kind of maybe worry about in the States whenever, you know, that bridge gets crossed, but it's going to take time for a lot of that stuff to get worked out. You know, we also saw Uniswap just, you know, got issued a Wells notice by the SEC as well. You know, I do think it's good that a lot of the stuff from 2022 has kind of got worked through. I think you've had a lot of, you know, like selling from Genesis and Gemini over the last couple of months, that, you know, that's been a lot of the GBTC outflows that we've seen. So like that stuff in terms of like a direct market impact has been something that I've kind of been watching, but I think a lot of that's gotten worked through. We've seen at least I don't want to take a couple of days of data and extrapolate out, but we've seen over the last couple of days that some of the GBTC flows have slowed. So, you know, that's a pretty good sign. But in terms of, you know, trying to, you know, base kind of how you're going to position yourself based on these cases, I think it's really difficult to do. I do think if Coinbase wins their case, it's a really positive catalyst for a lot of alts though. You know, I think if Coinbase were to win their case and if Uniswap was as well, if they get sued, I think alts probably would go crazy in that case.
And Will, you did say before we started recording that you felt like Coinbase was mispriced. And I was curious for your thoughts on why.
I do think it's mispriced, Laura. I do.
Come on, buddy.
All right, here we go. I think the story of Coinbase for me is basically the street isn't really pricing in the crypto native revenue that I think a lot of the crypto natives understand. I think Coinbase is probably the biggest kind of venture style bet in public markets since maybe Tesla about 5 years ago. I think the street still views Coinbase just purely as an exchange, where I would say they're kind of making, or at least throughout the bear market, they made a lot of kind of strategic pivots to kind of shift towards what I'm calling kind of a crypto super app, if you will. So, you know, for example, the staking revenue, I think the other big one is Base. So over the last 30 days, Base has done 30 mil of top line revenue for Coinbase just based on the sequencer fees, which annualizes out to like 360 mil a year. I think that could get a lot higher as Base gets more traction. You're starting to see a lot of projects kind of shift over to Base. And you know, you've got Frentech launching here in the next month. I think that'll probably have a massive kind of wealth effect on the Base chain. If you go back to the end of last year and basically look at the Jito airdrop, I remember I went to this like happy hours, like Monad and Wormhole hosted this happy hour. And everybody there was just, everyone was talking about how they had gotten the Jito airdrop. And then, you know, in the months after, if you go back and look at basically the activity on Solana, after the Jito airdrop, that's basically like right when it absolutely exploded. And I think kind of the wealth effect of that had a decent kind of part in kind of initiating that and kind of lighting off a catalyst of activity on Sol. I think Frentech's airdrop, they're saying that they're giving all of the tokens to users and they're potentially going to float the entire supply off the out of the gate. I think that could be a pretty big catalyst in terms of just the wealth effect and people speculating on other things with some of that money. And then I just think, you know, Base has a competitive advantage over all the other ETH L2s because of Coinbase's distribution, right? You know, they have 100 million users, all KYC'd, et cetera. They're just going to plug in, you know, all of the dApps on Coinbase right into the back end of the actual platform. And it's going to completely abstract away the fact that you're on chain and the users on Coinbase aren't even going to know that they're interacting on chain. So I personally feel really bullish on Base. I think it's probably the biggest competitor to Solana, just in terms of being kind of a, you know, high throughput, high TVS chain, that's pretty low fees, especially after EIP 4844. And I think that's something that, you know, the street doesn't even know what Base is, and they're definitely not kind of extrapolating out the potential of, you know, a ton of activity taking place there and the sequencer fees that Coinbase may benefit from that.
Yeah, this makes a lot of sense to me, but I agree that the people that these comments are meant for probably, yeah, they don't see any of that.
I mean, I'll make it simpler for you. Like, it's Binance Smart Chain for white people. That's what Base is.
Yeah, pretty much. I think that's a pretty good one-liner on it.
I love it. Arthur, keeping it simple. Yeah. All right. So in a moment, we're going to talk about other innovation on Bitcoin. But first, a quick word from the sponsors who make this show possible. Polkadot is the original and largest layer zero blockchain with over 2,000 plus developers. and the anticipated Polkadot 2.0 upgrade will be a massive accelerator for the ecosystem, upgrading the infrastructure with 8 times higher transaction throughput and twice as fast block times, perfectly tailored core time for the needs of every protocol, trustless bridges internally and into Ethereum, Cosmos, Near, Binance Smart Chain, and revised tokenomics and the implementation of a token burn to reduce inflation. Perfect for GameFi and DeFi to build, grow, and scale with one of the most active crypto communities in the space. Polkadot recently announced a partnership with Mythical Games, bringing top games like NFT Rivals with over 650,000 players and 43 million transactions to pave the way for GameFi and the Polkadot ecosystem. Get your Web3 ideas to market fast with economics that work for you. Think big, build bigger with Polkadot. Join the community at polkadot.network/ecosystem/community. Back to my conversation with Arthur and Will. So we were just talking about Base, which is a layer two on Ethereum, but we are currently seeing a trend of this upswell of new Bitcoin layer two projects, which is super interesting to me. There's Cetrea, which is ZK stuff, Botanix, which, oh my God, I interviewed them, I'm forgetting, but I think it's more like a side chain. I remember that it's decentralized, which is very interesting. There's Build on Bitcoin. There's a bunch of these like BitVM style things. And then, of course, there is the ones that have been around for a while, like Lightning, Stacks, Liquid, Rootstock. So do you think that you could see a future in which layer twos on Bitcoin are as active as they are currently on Ethereum?
For sure. But I think it's going to come down to what's the incentive for Bitcoin holders to use one of these. So is there some native, you know, proof of stake revenue that comes to providing your Bitcoin on one of these chains, however you want to characterize them? What sort of apps are on there? Like, they're going to have to give some yield to the user to get them to move their Bitcoin. Because if you think the Bitcoin, I guess, maxi is the most conservative in the crypto ecosystem, for them to move Bitcoin out of their wallet to one of these new chains, they're going to have something very compelling. And so I'm not super in the weeds on any of these new L2s. I know I see all sorts of Muppets coming to me on Telegram saying I'm starting the Bitcoin L2 fund. So there's something there, whether or not it's it'll make money, I don't know yet.
Yeah, it's not something that I've delved into a bunch. You know, I do think it's potentially a solution to the kind of long-term security budget problem that people like to talk about and ascribe that the Bitcoin has, you know, 100 years out whenever the issuance runs dry and there's no longer new coins coming into supply. The other thing is the ordinals as well. So the kind of the combination of, you know, potentially having some type of DeFi activity on top of Bitcoin with ordinals that's generating fees for the Bitcoin network. You know, I think that kind of adds to the security of the network long term. I think it's a positive thing.
That was actually my next question. Like, so first of all, so Will, you definitely feel like the security budget is a concern. And Arthur, do you agree with that?
Yes.
Well, so, you know, Will, you just said that you feel like ordinals are one way to resolve it, potentially these layer twos. Like, Arthur, what's your take on ordinals? And
I fucking love ordinals. And I have a bag to show. I'm obviously an early investor in Oil Wallet, which is, we're going to do some fun fucking shit. So keep your eye out on that. We got some good drops coming. But I think at the end of the day, bringing culture to any of these chains is obviously net positive. We've seen what meme coins have done to Solana. I mean, the bullshit Solana TPS has been shown to be absolutely bullshit as people have started to trade these things and 75% of transactions have started to fail on Solana. So good luck becoming the new ETH of this cycle. So I think that obviously when people want to have fun on chain, it drives activity, it drives fees. Why should that happen on Bitcoin? Anyone who says that this is trash or spam or whatever, the whole point is it's an open system. And so the block space is there. People have found a way to use it. They're willing to pay for it, so let them do it. So I think ordinals are great. If we can continue to push this narrative of ordinals and culture and digital artifacts on chain, we're going to bring a whole new type of person into the Bitcoin ecosystem and energize people who have just have Bitcoin sitting around doing nothing to express themselves on chain. So I love them.
And out of curiosity, I'm sure you both heard Roger Ver just came out with a book, Hijacking Bitcoin. And it has raised this Bitcoin block size debate yet again. This debate is actually filling my notifications on Twitter a lot, or it has in the last week. And obviously, you know, the Bitcoin block size being at 1 megabyte, it does sort of cap a little bit, you know, the transaction fees on there. So do you, like, is this coming up on your radar at all? Or do you feel like that's just like said and done? Or do you feel like this is reviving any kind of debate, or what's your take on that?
This is the first time I've even heard of Roger's new book, so I don't know.
Well,
yeah, same here. I mean, anybody can fork the code. It's open source code. Go for it. See how many people use it relative to the current Bitcoin.
How much more money does Roger want to lose on another fucking, you know, mining some dog shit chain?
Yeah, if someone wants to launch a fork, knock yourself out, go for it. But I won't be using it.
Okay. So similar to Ordinals, we are now seeing that Runes will be launching soon, which is a protocol meant to be similar to BRC20s. But I guess what's different is that it'll utilize the unspent transaction output model, or UTXO model. It'll launch it around the time of the halving. And the creator, Casey Rottermore, who also created Ordinals, said that these will be completely on-chain, pay fees on layer one. And he said on the Hell Money podcast, quote, if Runes are successful, they'll drain liquidity, technology, and attention away from other cryptocurrencies and bring it back to Bitcoin. So do you guys have any opinions on Runes? And do you also agree that they could take attention from other cryptos toward Bitcoin?
I mean, sure, but I guess we'll see. Proof is in the pudding. It depends on what you actually launch on them. Is there going to be some new meme coin or some new way to express yourself that's different? And then we'll see. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so not much of an opinion on this.
I mean, it's like anyone coming out saying, "Yeah, I've got this new layer two, and it does 1 million TPS." Good for you, buddy. Let's see some actual apps on this thing.
Well, so let's just talk about that for a second. I mean, we are seeing, like, you know, meme coins on Solana really obviously have become a huge thing. In general, it does feel like over the last few cycles, you know, Bitcoin has found its one little niche that it does well in, but then frequently, like, other trends take off on other chains. And Ordinals was the first time we saw a trend that had taken off on another chain actually come to Bitcoin. But I don't think it's, like, necessarily, yeah, as easy as just, you know, what happened. Like, I feel like there have been other attempts to do things that maybe haven't panned out in Bitcoin. So, like, do you have theories on what makes something successful, you know, when you try to transition it back to Bitcoin?
I just think it kind of is just basically what Arthur just said. You know, are people excited about it? Is it fun? You know, are your friends getting into it? And that kind of gives you FOMO to get involved with it. I think with a lot of these chains, the issue is maybe less about, you know, some of the aspects that have gotten, you know, commoditized to some degree in terms of, like, you know, having high TPS, for example. It's much more about, you know, BD or how do you kind of create economic incentives that are going to get you people that come on and use these things.
Yeah, we'll see. Who knows? It's got to be fun. It's going to be fun. It's got to be degen. Like, it's not fuck professional, all that, like, bullshit. Like, if it's not fun, if you're not doing it because you don't care if you lose all your money, but it's how you're having fun, then it's not going to drive any sort of attention. Because Bitcoin has a very good value prop. Bitcoin is crypto money. It's the hardest money in crypto. And so I know people are like, oh no, Bitcoin doesn't do anything. That's the fucking point. And so the conservative nature of Bitcoin is its biggest asset. So I'm not really that fussed that, okay, maybe, you know, meme coins can or can't come to Bitcoin, or DeFi can or cannot come to Bitcoin, or whatever. As long as we keep being the best money that's ever been created, then we're doing our job.
Yeah, one thing that I kind of forgot to mention earlier when we were talking about the regulatory stuff, I think you could make an argument that if you have, you know, all these DeFi projects that get shut down, that actually is kind of bullish for meme coins. I actually think of any kind of, you know, crypto project to potentially get an ETF moving forward, I think the one that has the highest likelihood could actually be Dogecoin, because it's a commodity, right? I mean, I would argue that it has a much purer commodity profile than, like, an Ethereum, for example. So I think kind of the barbell portfolio of having, you know, Bitcoin as hard money and then meme coins basically as these, you know, speculative assets, you know, speculative activity will continue to rise because of, you know, several things, from the fact that we have a dopamine epidemic in the world, but monetary debasement, you know, gambling trends are up and to the right ever since, you know, the US basically changed regulation around gambling from the federal level to the state level. All these things I think are aligning for kind of that barbell portfolio, if you will, of Bitcoin and meme coins to become increasingly favorable.
Wow, that is a super.
So, I mean, look at behind me. I got Omar with hat, right? He's rocking his dog with hat beanie. So y'all know what to do. The hat stays on.
So, Will, I want to hear a little bit more about why you think it is that Dogecoin is more of a pure commodity than Ether. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I'm being, I guess,
how
like
much Doge do you own before?
I don't own any Doge, but I'm being a little cheeky in saying that. But like, I think, you know, you have something like a Doge where it's a completely fair launch, nobody that controls it. I think that's like a much purer argument than the fact that it's a commodity. A lot of these meme coins, you know, if they have a fair launch and no pre-sale, nobody controls it. They're just kind of out there in existence. So I think those things are have a much higher likelihood of being viewed as commodities by regulators than maybe some DeFi project that's, you know, generating yield or like sharing fees with some of the users.
Well, I mean, it's also interesting because like Satoshi Nakamoto, the creator, Jackson Palmer, stepped away. So yeah, he in fact has denounced Dogecoin.
He rage quit.
Pretty much. Yeah, and then obviously now we're seeing this, you know, SEC investigation into the Ethereum Foundation. But actually, this goes back to my initial question then, or earlier question about layer twos on DeFi. So I know you guys are not regulatory people, but just obviously DeFi has taken off on Ethereum, and we have, you know, now Uniswap potentially being sued by the SEC. So, you know, I don't know if that might be another way that DeFi takes off on Bitcoin. I think the challenge really with Bitcoin, though, is that the Bitcoin scripting language is not set up to handle smart contracts in the way that Ethereum was initially. So I think, you know, that's why in a way there's like these workarounds almost. But anyway, that was just a thought that I had. So now let's actually talk about Ethereum and DeFi-ish things. Arthur, you are an investor in Athena, which is the new hot synthetic dollar, I will call it, not stablecoin. I know they're...
The guy will kill me if I don't say that.
So yeah, they're sensitive about the language. But I think it's good. I think it's good because it is true that the word stablecoin is probably not the word that you want to be using for something, you know, like an Athena, which isn't like a judgment on Athena itself. But the point is that, you know, the interest rate that it pays out can be quite high. The day before recording, Bloomberg reported that it was currently at 37%. And I'm sure you're aware there are some critics who say that Athena could be the next Terra Luna. So I'd be curious to hear what your response is to people who say that.
So the first thing is that anyone who says that, and they probably lost money in Terra Luna, they deserve to lose all their money because they didn't understand what they invested in. It was very clear from the start what Terra Luna was as an algorithmic stablecoin. I remember when I told my analyst, like, what the fuck is this Luna thing? Why is it like so valuable? And he's, you know, he did a little write up and then he sent me a paper by some professor. I forgot where the professor was from. And it was like how algorithmic stable coins die. So the death spiral. And I read this and I was like, okay, so this is how this is going to fail. And guess what? I still fucking bought some of it because number go up, right? And I guess knew that I was buying a piece of dog shit and hopefully I can get off the train before it goes to zero. But when the death spiral started in the summer of 2022, I was like, okay, well, here's exactly why this is going to fail. And it's not like, I know there's a whole like trial with Doquan and jump trading and all that kind of shit about, you know, the alleged fraud or whatnot. But in my mind, the thing told you exactly how it was going to fail. It failed in exactly the way that it was forecasted to fail. You have no, I don't know, reason to be upset that you lost your money. You just got out at the wrong time. And it's a completely different thing than saying Athena, which is a synthetic dollar. It's crypto hedged with a short perpetual swap or short futures contract. Completely different product. It doesn't have the anchor, I guess, fund or whatever you want to call it, that guaranteed this 20% interest rate. And no one knew where it came from. It came from essentially them selling Luna and Bitcoin to pay out UST rewards to people, which is completely different than saying, hey, I've got a variable interest rate that can go from negative to infinity, right? And it is completely dependent on the demand for leverage in the crypto ecosystem. And what are those synthetic dollars worth in terms of an interest rate? So, of course, Athena is not without risks. The funding rate could go negative. It could be less desirable to hold it because you're getting a better yield on some sort of real-world asset like a treasury bond on chain that yields 5% or whatever. The biggest risk is the capital that's held on the centralized crypto exchanges themselves. If they're not able to pay out profits correctly, if they get hacked or they steal the money, those are risks to Athena, right? It's just a different set of risks. Choose the risk you want. And then, you know, invest accordingly. But it's a completely different risk profile than Terra Luna. That's not to say that Athena couldn't fail, but it would fail for different reasons.
Arthur, I have a question for you, actually. So obviously, you know, being involved with BitMEX, being one of the founders of BitMEX, and, you know, basically pioneering the perps, how do you think, like, let's say Athena becomes like 20-25% of global OI on perps, do you think that kind of reduces the signal of funding rates? Because they're basically going to have, you know, they'll be pushing down funding so that funding won't be as much of a reflection of like the outright demand of people wanting to be long in the bull market.
Well, hopefully what Athena does is equalize what a dollar is worth in the euro dollar markets in TradFi and what a synthetic dollar is worth in the crypto capital markets. Right now there's a disconnect because traditional, you know, allocators are not willing to essentially take counterparty risk with all the centralized exchanges. So dollars synthetically are more expensive in crypto. Now, obviously, speculators are willing to pay that rate because what's Bitcoin up 50% this year? Okay, I'll pay an annualized 30% on a perp. Great. I'm still making money on, you know, on a interest rate basis. That's why people are willing to pay these high rates. But if Athena is very successful, let's say they're 30% of OI and they're pushing down funding rates, and so we equalize at what is a dollar worth in TradFi and what's a synthetic dollar worth in crypto, then I think that's a good outcome because it makes leverage trading cheaper and hopefully the derivatives markets grow in terms of the open interest for crypto.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you're basically just saying it allows more people to be long crypto because they don't have to pay as much funding.
Yeah. And so a dollar outside of crypto and a synthetic dollar inside of crypto should be equalized. Athena is just one of many entities arbing that difference.
Got it.
Huh. And so, Arthur, one question, well, actually, I had two questions for you. One is, first of all, you know, Athena just launched in late February and the current total value locked is already $2.4 billion. Did you expect it to get that big that quickly?
No, and I think that's a testament to the excellent execution by Guy and his team. Like, I met them in August of last year. They asked us to be a founding advisor and help them out with, you know, different things. And, you know, I've been speaking to them quite regularly and giving my thoughts on this or that. Obviously, I'm not involved in the day-to-day running of the thing, but I have to say I'm very impressed with what they've been able to do in less than a year that I've known them. This is probably one of the best teams that I've ever seen in crypto in terms of the execution, whether it's the marketing side, it's getting the tech right, it's understanding the risks. Guy's a great communicator. He's, you know, going on all sorts of different crypto podcasts, explaining, taking the heat for people saying you're a scammer, this is just another Doquan piece of shit. You know, why, you know, I can do this too myself. Great, well then fucking do it. He strapped up, built a team, and built Athena. What the fuck have you done? So I think it's a testament to the team about why they've been able to garner, what, $2.4 billion in TVL since February.
And so now they're onboarding Bitcoin, you know, to do basically the same strategy instead of just Ethereum. And I was curious, and I don't know if this will have an effect, but could the Bitcoin halving affect the USDE yields in any fashion?
If it, it would be a second order effect in terms of how are people trading the perps? What is the funding? Is it lower? Is it high? I'm not really sure. Again, it's a variable rate. So whatever the market is willing to pay, then they'll be able to capture that.
Okay. So now let's zoom out. Like, we've been focused mostly on Bitcoin, but obviously we have often seen that, you know, when it comes to these crypto markets, like as the price of Bitcoin rises, then interest goes to other altcoins. So what effect do you think we'll see this cycle on, you know, things like Ethereum, Solana, just like the rest of the crypto markets? Like, how are you seeing things play out the next?
Well, what bags do you got? I want to hear some. I need some, you know, what's going to pop here?
Well, how degenerate do we want to get here?
Oh, just DJ to the max, man. I'm trying to make money. Left curve it.
My biggest meme coin bag is this thing called Zen coin. So Zen is this very big
Pomp
thing.
Pomp was pushing this thing too.
I got Pomp to buy my bags like 3x higher than what I originally got in. So I put Pomp on. But you know, Zen is this very big thing in the US. It's like a nicotine pouch, basically. People use it as like an alternative to smoking or vaping. It's become very popular with guys my age, like 20 to 25 year old dudes. It's also very associated with like based culture. So a lot of like, I don't know if you know who the Nelk boys are. They're like very popular kind of like streamers or like media personalities with people around my age, as well as like Tucker Carlson has been a big proponent of Zen. So it's kind of got associated with kind of the quote unquote like based culture, if you will. They just launched on Base, and then they're about to launch a rewards program where you can scan the back of the tin. Like, there's QR codes on the back of the tin, and you get tokens. So I think it's an interesting.
That's pretty interesting.
So it's like, if you think about it, right? If I was going to be on like the right side of the bell curve, it's the first ever kind of crypto rewards program that subsidizes both the usage of a product and on the company's end, on PMI's end, subsidizes the revenue in theory. I think the biggest risk is obviously like PMI comes after them and like says, you need to shut this thing down. But in theory, you know, people are getting basically paid to you know, use Zen in the tokens, then that allows them to purchase more Zen, or, you know, the Zen tins that they're purchasing are becoming free while also contributing to PMI's, you know, Zen sales as well. So that's one thing I've been excited about. I just think in general, the meme coins that I've been interested in are like the culture coins. So basically like tokenizing different cultural movements. I don't have any bags of this, but I do like Andrew Kang's thesis around Trump. And just basically, you know, if these things are like tokenized attention, how many times is Trump going to get mentioned in the media between now and the end of the year? Probably a lot more, you know, more than zero. So things like that are pretty interesting to me. Outside of that, like I mentioned, you know, Coinbase is probably my largest holding outside of Bitcoin.
Arthur, what about you? What are your theories?
I mean, obviously Solana is the hot kid on the block this cycle. And we're seeing that their TPS numbers are completely bullshit, which is fine. I mean, that's just a function of them being successful at attracting a meme coin degenerate trading crowd, and they want to all trade on Solana. Does that mean that Solana is going to flip ETH in terms of market cap? I don't think so. But again, as you said, as the Bitcoin price rises, everybody feels wealthier, and they get into all these sort of, you know, different sorts of alts. Obviously, I've been pushing this narrative like AI coins. I've been, you know, a big Filecoin believer, but there's other ones out there as well, like Tau and BitTensor has done very, very well. You've got, I think, IO.net as a big airdrop or launch that people are like FOMOing about. So there's all these different sort of narratives. And then you have all the different new L1, L2s that are launching this cycle. So again, all the alts are going to rally. The question for an investor is picking the one that resonates with you the most, being concentrated in your bets so that you're making the most amount of money given this particular point in time that you can, because obviously most of these things are completely dog shit and bullshit, and they're not going to live up to what they said they're going to do on their nice looking pitch deck. And so you want to be well clear of this shit when the market starts sort of rolling over, when people start asking the question of, oh, well, let me see all those users. Let me actually measure the TPS versus what you told me about, you know, 2 years ago when I invested in this thing. How many AIs have actually used in this? Of how much data have you actually put on the chain versus what I thought 2 years ago? So when you start asking those questions, you want to be well clear of most of this shit. Even the good stuff is going to get smoked. So we're in a great time. It's time to, you know, strap it on, go long, forget about it for a while. Don't get too intellectual about things.
Yeah, I think just in general, like the natural flow that we kind of see is, you know, as in like most assets, you know, at the beginning of the cycle, people hold Bitcoin. And then I think in this cycle, it's also been ETH and Sol as well. And then, you know, as the wealth effect grows because of the appreciation of those kind of core value assets, the money just flows down the risk curve. One other thing that I guess I forgot to mention that I'm pretty excited about is SocialFi. I don't know if either of you have used Frentech, but the beta version, that the V1 was pretty clunky and not very smooth at all. It was like super, super slow. But the concept itself of basically kind of like, you know, not token gating, but they're calling them keys, but essentially token gating the access to somebody and kind of like a private group chat, or being able to kind of, you know, ask somebody questions or get their market thoughts or whatever it may be. Or even if you had like kind of non-crypto people get involved, like, you know, big celebrities, be able to just have conversations with them. I think that could be pretty big. And I think that probably has the highest likelihood of any crypto app to bring in like non-crypto people.
Huh. And wait, you would say that even over something like Farcaster, which already, I know it's not SocialFi exactly.
It's essentially, yeah, very similar applications, right? I just think these SocialFi applications probably have the highest probability of getting any of these, like, you know, mainstream artists, celebrities, influencers, whatever you want to call them, involved in crypto. They're not going to come and like do some, you know, liquidity farming or something, right? Like what's much more likely is they come on one of these apps like a Frentech or a Farcaster, where, you know, the kind of on-chain experience is almost completely abstracted away. And then all they have to do is basically go on like a group chat and they're talking to their fans, and, you know, they're able to also filter out all of the haters as well, because nobody's going to want to buy your key. No one's going to want to pay $1,000 for your key if they hate you. So you're basically kind of in this private group of people that, you know, they want to actually hear what you have to say, et cetera.
And then just to circle back about the AI thing that you both were saying, there is so much hype in this kind of crypto plus AI sector, and there's so many different ways that you can bring these two technologies together. So out of kind of the different variations that we're seeing out there, are there any that you are particularly like more excited about that you think are like more investable or interesting?
I mean, I think you don't want to invest in anything that's like an application on top of some sort of like open source model. Like, you want to invest in sort of a AI infrastructure, whether that's compute power, storage, chips. And so all the really successful narratives in crypto are like, oh, we're going to create a decentralized network of people providing compute power, or we're going to create a decentralized network of people data storage for AI. That's the sort of stuff you want to get involved in, because then you don't have to pick a winner. It's like, how many startups is OpenAI or Anthropic going to put out of business because they just decide to do that same service themselves in-house? And we're already seeing that with, you know, a lot of VC Silicon Valley startups just being zeros immediately once OpenAI decides, okay, we'd like to do that too. Cool. We have better distribution. We have the model. And we can completely disintermediate you. So I think you want to, as I like to say, focus on the AI food groups, compute power, and storage. Any sort of coins related around that, it's very easy to build a very convincing narrative around those.
Yeah, I'm bullish on like the crypto AI overlap. I just think from like a narrative perspective, it makes a ton of sense. I'm not positioned in anything though, but I do like the Filecoin thesis. I think it makes a lot of sense.
All right. So last couple quick questions. We started by talking about the halving, and you know, as we mentioned, there's often a new all-time high after the halving, but we said this year it's going to be a little different. So out of curiosity, what's your Bitcoin price projection for year's end?
This year end, or it's in general?
We can do a year end for 2024, plus also what you think the next all-time high will be.
Okay, my year end price prediction is $99,999, and my all-time high prediction is 900,009. Well, basically $1 less than 1 million Bitcoin.
Wait, for in this next cycle?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well,
cycle defined as in, because we kind of had like a different high,
whatever we get to, like Nate,
different year, whatever year cycle, 3 years, 5 years. All right, look, I'll say 120K in a year, and I'll say 500. I'll be a little more conservative than Arthur by end of cycle.
For this next cycle. Okay. Yeah. And how are you defining cycle?
Just based on whenever this kind of liquidity cycle peaks out, and I don't know, you have like, you know, some G7 country that comes out and bans Bitcoin, and then people all of a sudden are scared to hold it or something. And I think that's probably like the most likely catalyst that tops out this current cycle, is you have some type of like coordinated, basically like capital controls, like money is leaving, you know, a country. We've already started to kind of see like foreshadowing of this in countries like Nigeria, which like obviously like doesn't really matter, but I think there's a decent likelihood you could see that on like a broader scale at some point. And that's probably, I think, like the thing that maybe tops out this cycle.
Huh. Arthur, what do you think of that?
I think that if they were going to ban it, they would try to do it already. They would have done it already. My base case is look at China. In China, Bitcoin is not illegal. It's not illegal to hold Bitcoin. It's illegal to do a lot of things in China. Obviously, very controlling sort of policies that they run over there, but they have not deemed Bitcoin illegal, because I think they know it's very good advertising when you make something illegal that you can't actually enforce in a broad sense, right? Individually, yes. Police can go over to your house and put a hammer, put an M16 to your head and say, give me the private keys to, you know, a few different individuals. But like on a broad scale, it's very hard to enforce a ban on private ownership of Bitcoin, which is different than something that's in gold, right? Because 1933, you know, FDR in the US banned private ownership of gold. Very easy to enforce that policy because gold's fucking heavy. And, you know, it's very easy to, you know, find somebody who's storing a lot of gold versus a private key that's held in your head.
All right. Well, this has been a hugely fascinating discussion. Thank you both so much. I personally am also excited to see whether the halving occurs on April 20th, 420, or on the 19th, which is, I think, because originally this was projected for 420, and now I think it's shifting a little bit.
Well, under GMT time, or like, what time zone? It could be straddling. It's very subjective there.
I know. But the latest estimate I saw was the evening, UTC time on the 19th. So obviously, at least on the East Coast, that would be still the afternoon of the 19th. I don't know. What would that be in Asia?
That would be the 20th.
Oh, it would. Okay. So maybe for one half of the globe, you'll get to experience it on the 20th. Anyway. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining. Where can people learn more about each of you?
At Crypto Haze on Twitter, at Maelstrom Fund on Twitter as well. And I have a Substack, Crypto Haze.
You can find me on Twitter at W Clementi III, and then the research firm at reflexivityresearch.com.
Perfect. Well, thank you both so much for joining Unchained.
Awesome.
Thanks so much for joining us today. To learn more about Arthur, Will, and the Bitcoin halving, check out the show notes for this episode. Unchained is produced by me, Laura Shin, with help from Matt Pilchard, Juan Aranovich, Megan Gavis, Shashank, and Margaret Curia. Thanks for listening.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.